1460 WVOX.
Whitney Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX AM 1460. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. The program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound. It can also be heard live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. One can also call directly to the station at 914-636-0110, but please stay germane to our topic. My guest is author, Roosevelt Fellow, Richard Kirsch, and of course, author of Fighting for Our Health, the epic battle to make healthcare a right for the United States. And our subject is an insider's view of healthcare reform. As I say each week, the mission of the Advocates is to bring to the public different views on public policy issues. Public policy, therefore, is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. To that end, many of my shows are devoted to that purpose. Welcome, Richard Kirsch, to the Advocates, and thank you for joining me on WVOX.
Great to be with you this afternoon, Richard.
Thank you. Richard Kirsch is a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and the author of Fighting for Our Health, as I mentioned, the epic battle to make healthcare right in the United States, which was recently published in just this February 2012. I have a copy in front of me, quite interesting, by the Rockefeller Institute Press. He's also a senior advisor to U.S. Action and an institute fellow at the Rockefeller Institute. Prior to joining the Roosevelt Institute, he was the National Campaign Manager of Healthcare for America Now. That's HCAN. Mr. Kirsch also appeared on PBS's The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, ABC World News Tonight, Good Morning America, Fox, C-SPAN, The Colbert Report, and has been quoted in The New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and other national newspapers, as well as NPR's Morning Edition. From 1985 to 2008, he served as the executive director of Citizen Action of New York, a grassroots citizens organization with 20,000 members and 7 offices in New York. He also served as the executive director of the Public Policy and Education Fund of New York, which deals with the citizens' action. He's also author of several studies on healthcare reform, including Managed Care Bill of Rights. He was honored by Families USA in 2001 as the National Healthcare Consumer Advocate of the Year. He has a vast background in this. He received his Bachelor of Arts with honors from Brown University in 1974 and an MBA from the University of Chicago in 1980. In fact, last week we had on David Barker, who is a doctorate from the University of Chicago, talking and also an economist for the Federal Reserve. Richard, you wrote in your introduction to your book, Fighting for Our Health, the campaign we built was many years in the making. It had its roots in part in the American left that originated in the Vietnam era. I've been working in that tradition, building community labor coalitions to fight for economic justice issues since 1980. The success of healthcare for America Now stemmed from lessons learned and the relations built 30 of those most in 30 of the most conservative years in American modern political history. You talk about how the country has struggled over the last 30 years to establish economic social justice. But didn't this struggle begin with Secretary of Labor Francis Perkins' effort to include health care insurance in the Social Security Act of 1935 and FDR's call for a second Bill of Rights?
Yes, Richard. And, you know, you could trace it before that, too. But certainly in the heart of the New Deal, health care was the one program that didn't get passed. There's a story about how when Frances Perkins was chosen by FDR, she brought him a long list of programs that she wanted to see enacted. And he said, yes, let's try to get all of those. And then when she left, years later, after FDR had died and when President Truman had taken over, she said the one thing that she most regretted was the one thing that she couldn't get accomplished, and that list was health care.
Mm.
So it's been a big, it's been something that presidents like FDR and Truman and others have tried, and up to President Obama had failed.
Right. You know, by the middle of the last administration, our healthcare system, which provided the best medical care in the world for the most people, seemed to be coming apart at the seams. The system, which is married mostly to one's employer, was facing the specter of a potential meltdown. Higher and higher premiums, greater co-premiums and co-pays, higher and higher deductibles, more restrictions regarding preconditions, and a plethora of other problems which were growing exponentially. Richard, was this as serious as I've described? And what was the what was driving this, let's call it an accident about to happen in terms of healthcare?
It is absolutely as serious as you've described, and it's been a crisis that's been building for a long time. It gets worse every iteration, but that same list of problems describes the situation we had in 1993 when President Clinton made this one of the centerpieces of his administration, wasn't able to get it passed. And you know, in to a lesser extent, would it describe what we saw when even Presidents Nixon and President Carter made some attempts, not quite as enthusiastic, to get these passed. We have a system that provides high-quality care for some people, but has actually poor quality for a great many people because people don't have coverage, don't get in the system early enough, end up with serious diseases that could be prevented. We have a system that people who even would get too much care, because the incentives are to provide care, regardless of whether it's needed or not. And we have very, very high costs, much higher than our competitors around the world. But despite that high cost, we don't get the quality. We're ranked 37th in the world in quality, and that's because we have such high incidence of things like asthma and diabetes, and even child mortality is higher in this country than in other developed countries.
And you know, it's interesting. I don't think people really understand the kind of ball and chain they're connected to their employer. You know, there's a sense of a lack of mobility because their healthcare is connected to them. And it's very interesting, as the co-pays go up, let's call it co-premiums are much more important than co-pays. And let's say, and deductibles go up, the average individual with a family could be in a plan that he's paying 25% for a $16,000 plan, $1,000 a deductible, and he could be in the hole $5,000 before his child gets an inoculation. And people
right.
And people are dropping out from that system. They were, at the time Obama proposes, something like $1,000 a day. Could the health insurance industry continue to stand if this hemorrhage continued?
Well, the interesting thing is the health insurance industry is making more money by the kind of plans you just described. They love high deductible plans. They love plans where the routine costs are shifted onto families and they pay for more catastrophic costs. So they're very comfortable with those kind of plans. And they're, you know, been very profitable. The real question is not whether the health insurance industry can stand, is whether the American public can
right.
stand.
Well, in a trying to say was, in a sense, by the dropout of people, the premiums went up for the
right,
for the balance,
and they're making more money.
Right.
I mean, they're making more money by insuring fewer people all the time. And you know, as you say, we're in a situation where right now, if you lose your job, you're going to lose your health insurance. If you change jobs, you wonder whether your new job will have health coverage. If you want to start a small business, you don't think you'll be able to do that because you can't afford health coverage. If you're in a position to retire early, you can't do that because you won't have health coverage. And where more than half the bankruptcies that people experience, medical costs are part of it.
Right.
And that's the big problem that the Affordable Care Act was meant to solve. And it will solve in 2014. What people don't understand, and I know why this is true, is that the heart of the law that was passed doesn't kick in for another couple of years, the part that will actually solve the problems I just described.
And maybe people are old enough to remember when most people had Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and then the Oxfords and the private companies came in and raided the healthy people, went to companies, suggested that they sponsor a different type of health care program. And it's very interesting because in regards to health care, it was almost like a lost leader for companies to hire people. We'll pay for your health care. We'll provide this. And not only that, the company will have a drug plan. Now we see the loss leader going the other way. As a person leaves and as new companies come ahead, they're not offering defined benefit plans for people. They're not offering cafeteria plans. They're not offering paying for all the premiums. So it seems that it's the loss leader in reverse. Companies are saying, hey, I can save money on the next generation of employees. You know, let them pay for the health care.
Right. And it's, and you know, in a situation where in a global economy where other countries have much lower health care costs because they have national health insurance, we remain at a real disadvantage. And it's part of a whole pattern of employers cutting wages and benefits and shipping jobs overseas. And part of reversing that is making health care more affordable in this country for employers as well as employees. And that's, again, the direction that the Affordable Care Act will help with. It'll help both by making health care something that everybody has, or almost everybody has, so it doesn't become such a war between employers about shifting costs by not providing coverage. And it'll also start bringing down health care costs in the country, making us more competitive over time.
Yeah, no question. You know, before we go to a break, you know, health care is available to most Americans in one form or another. Millions of Americans are though crowding into emergency rooms in most of our hospitals. And before we go to the break, did this exacerbate the problem of skyrocketing costs and institutional insolvency, these 47 million people without coverage?
Of course. Ending up in the emergency room is a very expensive place to get care, and in addition to which, it probably means you're there for conditions that, if were treated early, would be cost a lot less expensive to care, things like asthma and diabetes and high blood pressure. And then hospitals are oftentimes left with trying to pay for those costs, and they shift those costs to employers and other people and employees who would have coverage.
Yeah, I have to go to a break. Richard, my guest is author and Roosevelt Fellow Richard Kirsch. Our subject is an insider's view of healthcare reform. He's the author of Fighting for a Health. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX Radio 1460. We'll be back in a second.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour, here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, U.S. stocks are mostly lower on concerns over the details of a new bailout plan for Greece. Fitch Ratings Agency also downgrading Greece further into junk status following the bailout deal. At noon Eastern, the Dow now off by some 43 points. A trade group says sales of previously owned homes were up in January to the highest level in nearly 2 years. The National Association of Realtors' so-called existing home sales gained more than 4%. That's the highest level since May of 2010. And Honda is recalling nearly 46,000 Odyssey minivans because the rear door can fall on people unexpectedly. The problem affects minivans from 2008 to 2009 model years that have power lift gates. Honda says the problem has caused two minor injuries. The company says it will send letters to van owners next month with instructions about the recall. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Ashley Webster.
You want to know what can bring any good business person to their knees? A power outlet. Seriously, I've seen it. People in suits crawling around looking for a plug. That's when I tell them about the HP Folio. It's the thin and light business ultrabook with the longest battery life. And it's inspired by Intel and powered by the Intel Core i5 processor. Buy direct at hp.com/folio. Based on internal battery versus published internal battery time of competitor ultrabook batteries in the U.S. as of 1/18/2012.
Global on WVOX.com. Call David O'Shaughnessy for more information. 914-636-1460.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, Richard Kirsch, a fellow of the Roosevelt Institute. He's the author of Fighting for Our Health. We're talking about the epic struggle of healthcare reform in America. Again, you're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM and live streaming on WVOX.com. Most people feel that the nexus for legislation comes out of thin air and into the head of some legislator who sometimes clears it with a governor or the president's office, builds a coalition of his peers, does some arm twisting and gets it passed. Other folks believe that a general or specific idea is passed from the executive branch to the legislative committee for consideration and debate. And this seems pretty far from the truth. Richard, could you tell us how a grassroots strategy was planned, organized, and executed, and who they had to appeal to get this done?
Sure. And that's what Fighting for Our Health is really about. It's about how ordinary people, when they're part of a well-organized strategy, really can make a huge difference. And the genesis for the Affordable Care Act and the whole framework was developed over several years. It was developed through work that we did, through grassroots work and through research and through building coalition around the idea that to appeal to the public and solve the policy problems, we should offer a plan that allows people to keep what they have when it's working, but also guarantees that what they have has improvements. So that means for, say, employer-based coverage, that things like right now employer-based coverage, your company can limit how much it will pay. So if you get very sick, it'll just simply stop paying. So let's fix problems like that. The genesis was let's provide people a choice so they're not stuck just with private insurance. Let's try to get a public insurance plan to compete with private insurance because Medicare as a public insurance plan has a much better record of cost control and also doesn't deny care to people when they need it the way private insurance companies often do in order to protect their profits. Some of this work was done in Massachusetts where legislation was passed on a bipartisan basis, led by a Massachusetts group called Healthcare for All, working with Democrats and Republicans, but building a base to pass what's really Romney Care, which has many of the features, doesn't have the public option, but has many of the features that were passed nationally. All that was in the policy. On the political thing, we needed to build a big base of support for this. And we spent a couple years taking organizations that had a shared set of values and principles and bringing them to a big coalition called Healthcare for America Now, a place where they could come around their shared principles and vision with a strategy to organize, not inside the Beltway, but outside the Beltway, with organizers in more than 40 states, getting small business people and community people to work together to raise their voices to get healthcare done.
You know, as we learned in the 1960s regarding the battle for Medicare, the greatest resistance came from the AMA, many individual doctors and strict constitutionalists who were always on the watch for socialist-style seepage into our free market system. With that in mind, where were the greatest resistance centered and the insurance carriers, the healthcare establishment, or then the emerging far-right Tea Party?
This time was different than in the past. As you said, in the FDR and in the Truman era, the AMA was the biggest problem. In the Clinton era, the insurance industry was the biggest problem. This time around, the biggest actually resistance was political, where you had the Republican Party and then backed by the Tea Party movement, and those are very closely linked because a lot of Republicans forces funded and organized a lot of the Tea Parties, decided that for both political and ideological reasons they wanted to resist the Obama's proposal. Politically, they didn't want Obama to succeed, and ideologically, they didn't want the idea that government should play a role in guaranteeing coverage to people. Even though the plan that Obama was putting forth was based on a lot of conservative ideas that conservatives had supported in the past. So you had an ideological... and then you also behind that had some corporate interests, particularly the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which basically did not want any kind of government role. They wanted just to keep the free market. And the insurance industry at first was mildly supportive of the legislation, but as things got further along, they went into opposition and they laundered $86 million through the Chamber of Commerce to oppose the bill.
You know, before we get into the politics of Washington, referred often by talking heads as inside the Beltway, Senator John McCain, the Republican presidential nominee in 2008, had his own health care proposal. What was his plan and how did it differ with the Obama White House, that what the Obama White House envisioned?
His plan was very, very different. It didn't do anything to make coverage more available to people. It was based on saying, instead of providing more regulation, being sure that your plan is actually affordable, we're going to encourage high deductible plans. Instead of saying your plan has to be sure it's got a decent level of benefits, we're going to let plans provide any level of benefits they want. And then we're actually going to tax your health care benefits at work. right now, if you are your employer pays for your health coverage, the cost of that is not charged as income to you. So you don't have to pay taxes on it. McCain actually wanted to tax people for their value of the health care at work and trade that in for a tax credit to buy health coverage. One problem with that is that the tax credit was not nearly as much worth as the loss was from having employer-provided coverage, which would have happened if it was taxed. So the McCain plan was basically, we called it on your own with the insurance industry. It tried to move people to a plan of unregulated private insurance where your employer did not provide coverage for you.
Yeah. You know, it always seems that the right wing of the Republican Party, or even the Republican Party, is always throwing a bone to industry. Privatization of Social Security, wouldn't that be fantastic for Wall Street? You know, there'd be another plethora of IRAs and, you know, Roths and 401ks to administer. You know, it's very interesting, but the vagaries of the market, they don't seem to be concerned about. You know, before we come to a break, what's your perspective on the single payer, and did you favor that and with your group?
Well, single payer, for listeners, is basically the same kind of plan as Medicare, where you have national health insurance, where everyone would be covered by one government-run health insurance plan. And that, from a point of view of policy, from the point of view of lowering costs and getting rid of the high costs of the insurance company middlemen, and also having a plan that isn't based on profit. So Medicare has lower costs than private insurance and doesn't deny care. It makes great sense from a policy point of view. The problem politically is that Americans want choice, and they're very, very scared of losing what they had. And if our coalition or the president had supported a plan that said everyone's going to get one government health insurance plan, it would have been dead on arrival, not just in Congress, but with the American public. The most important thing is the American public wants choice as well as guarantees of good quality and good coverage that's affordable. And so that's why, while single payer is good in theory, we needed to find something which would work in the United States, and that's why we supported a plan that included regulating private insurance and giving people a choice of regulated private insurance or a public health insurance plan. Unfortunately, the last thing didn't get through the legislative process.
You know, we have to go to a commercial break. I'm with my guest, Richard Kirsch, Roosevelt Fellow, and our subject is an insider's view of healthcare reform. He's the author of Fighting for Own Health. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM.
With world and national news three times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Ron Flatter. A deadly crash at a busy train station in Argentina. Officials in Buenos Aires confirming 49 people died, including at least one child. More than 600 other people were injured. Passengers removed from the trains through windows and extracted with makeshift pulleys. Videos posted online show a bus going through red lights at a railroad crossing onto the tracks just as a train was approaching a platform. That train was derailed, crashing into yet another train on parallel tracks. As part of Black History Month, a new museum is now being built to honor African Americans.
It was on this ground long ago that lives were once traded, where hundreds of thousands once marched for jobs and for freedom.
President Obama at today's groundbreaking on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Fox News. We report, you decide.
This is Bill O'Shaughnessy with an important word for business owners in our region. These changing times, I think, present a whole new set of problems for proprietors, for owners of independent regional companies. And thus, we recommend highly the Alan D. Rosenberg Company. Founded by Alan Rosenberg, he's a wonderful man, as a specialized accounting practice for independent local companies. If you're looking for a little more brain power from an independent accounting practice, we suggest you call the Alan D. Rosenberg Accounting Firm. The number is 914-722-6901 in the county, or in Manhattan, 212-382-3939. In Westchester, 914-722-6901. 6901. These guys really know.
Whitney Radio has some very good news for anyone who wants to keep their car looking like new after an accident. New Rochelle now has its very own high-tech modern body repair shop, and your car is in for a real treat. Laser Frame and Body Repair is the name of this spectacular new entity, and it's just around the corner from our radio stations on 74 Potter Avenue. Owner Martin Goldsmith's new Laser Frame and Body Repair is now open, specializing in foreign and domestic automobiles, and they're even an authorized Lexus repair shop. Laser Frame and Body Repair guarantees all work done to your car and offers free estimates. And they also make it easy for you with free pickup and delivery and 24-hour towing. So if your car needs some cleaning up after an accident, rely on Martin Goldsmith's new Laser Frame and Body Repair on 74 Potter Avenue in New Rochelle, just off 5th Avenue. They know the business and they know how to get your car back on the road looking like new. The number is 914-632-8100. 632-8100. They take great pride in your car and it shows. Laser Frame and Body Repair, now opened on Potter Avenue in New Rochelle.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Westchester County and the vicinity for this afternoon, we'll see partly to mostly cloudy skies. Continued mild highs will climb into the upper 50s. Cloudy showers likely this evening, overnight lows dropping into the lower 40s. Generally cloudy, a few showers, and a period of some rain possible developing later in the afternoon on Thursday, highs into the middle 50s. Showers likely, breezy weather, middle 50s on Friday. Looks sunny and colder, middle 40s for Saturday and Sunday. I'm Steve Pelletieri Jr. reporting for WVOX Worldwide and WVIPHD.
No matter where in the world you travel, you'll still be at home when you listen online.
Where am I?
WVOX.com.
1460 WVOX.
Now, back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with my guest, Richard Kirsch, a fellow of the Roosevelt Institute. He's the author of Fighting for Our Health. We've been talking about the epic struggle of healthcare reform in America. You're listening to the Advocates, of course, on WVOX Radio, 1460 AM, live streaming at WVOX. You know, in February of 2010, a Center for Public Integrity analysis of the Senate lobbying disclosure form showed that more than 1,750 companies and organizations hired about 4,525 lobbyists, 8 for each members of Congress, to influence health reform bills in 2009. The list of companies and organizations that worked to put their imprint on legislation is diverse, ranging from healthcare interests, advocacy groups, to giant corporations, small businesses, American Indian tribes, religious groups, and universities. The amount expended by these groups approached $1 billion. Richard, were all these groups opposed to healthcare reform? Or was it a matter of just dollars or often ideology that caused this opposition?
Well, in terms of the many of those lobbying groups you talked about, many were actually for health care reform. And unlike in the past, where you had most of the medical industry opposed to it, major parts of the industry were actually supportive. So that the hospital industry, the AMA, the drug industry, they all supported the legislation. Now, having said that, it didn't mean that they didn't want to get something out of it. Mm. They wanted to shape the legislation, and one thing the White House actively did was negotiate with the major industries I just mentioned to get their support, and they did that in return for being sure the legislation did not include things that they were very unhappy with. Mm. And in some cases, and many cases, they benefited, because if you take the 50 million uninsured Americans, and you provide coverage to at least 30 million and hopefully more of them through the legislation, these groups are going to get new customers and make more money. In return, they gave up some revenues, and that was the trade-off they agreed to. We'll get new customers. We'll give up. We'll lower our prices, lower the amount we're getting paid for some of the services provided, but we're going to make up for it by getting more customers. And then other groups, you mentioned the American Indians. The legislation includes a historic improvement in the American Indian Health Service that's been long overdue. And so they lobbied for that, and they were backed by senators and members of Congress from the West, and our coalition also supported them. So there's a lot of jockeying. There were clearly groups that were opposed. And ideologically, there was a tremendous opposition, and politically, there was a tremendous opposition. But the lobbyists played more of a role of what can we, this legislation is likely to pass, what can we do to be sure it meets our needs?
And, you know, and so you're saying basically that both sides seem to have adequate funding, unlike some of the issues that have come down, like Citizens United and other issues where one side has an economic imperative and the other side has a philosophical and less connected monetary endgame. You're saying that some of these groups that were supportive were able to have their message heard. Is that correct?
Well, it's important to distinguish between, you know, what's inside the Beltway and outside the Beltway. And so inside the Beltway, if you have, you hire a lot of lobbyists and you make campaign contributions, you're going to be heard. And the question is what kind of influence you're going to have. And these groups had influence on the shaping of the legislation in specific ways. However, the larger contours were still shaped by the president and members of Congress. Now, one group that did end up going into opposition pretty vociferously and had a lot of lobbyists, a couple thousand alone, was the health insurance industry. And they actually were sort of mildly supportive, warily supportive, for the first few months of 2009. But by the late summer of 2009, they actually decided to come out against it pretty aggressively. They lobbied against it. More importantly, they funneled $86 million laundered, really, for the Chamber of Commerce to fight it. So it was a mixed bag. One thing that was true this time, though, is that for the first time ever, there was an organized, well-funded grassroots campaign to support the legislation, and that's what I had the honor of leading, and I talk about that campaign in Fighting for Our Health, because that was a huge difference. We knew we could not compete inside the Beltway, you know, on Capitol Hill, with their army of lobbyists. But where we could compete, and we could win, actually, was by organizing ordinary Americans in communities around the country. And what I talk about a lot in the book are profiles of those Americans, how they organized, their stories, and how they got members of Congress to pay attention to them more than the lobbyists.
Right. You know, it's very interesting because you also discussed in your book the reluctance of the White House of having an outside strategy and their fear of being perceived as being pushed by others with their own private agendas. Was this strategy by the White House too cautious? Could they have used more vocal grassroots support?
Well, they wanted vocal grassroots support. They just wanted only for what they wanted.
Right, and they had control of it, in other words.
They were glad when we were out there campaigning hard for the legislation, and that's most of what we did. But sometimes we were pushing to make the legislation better, oftentimes just to keep the original plan the president had supported. And you know, there's a famous story here, which as someone who's spent a lot of time studying and writing about FDR, you'll appreciate, Richard, which is that there's a story that during the New Deal, supporters of the New Deal program came to the president and he said, "I agree with you, now make me do it." And what FDR was saying is, "I'm going to get a lot of pressure from people to whittle this down, to oppose to it. I need outside pressure to do it so that I can be in the middle." Unfortunately, that's not the tack that the Obama administration took. They wanted to silence those of us who were working to keep the bill strong, and that, you know, that makes it easier for them to compromise, but that's bad because it means that they're more likely to compromise. So that was the tension we had with the White House.
It's a sort of playing both ends against the middle. You want hold me back, I'll kill him. You know what I mean? Don't let me get in that fight, you know. On the other hand, you know, you make a very interesting reference to FDR, and FDR also said something very interesting and cogent that he learned as a longtime president, operative, and an individual how to keep many balls in the air at the same time. I won't add the rest of that to it, but it's a famous metaphor about him, was that he said a leader who gets too far out ahead of the public and looks over his shoulder and sees one not there loses his ability to lead. So you always have to lead in a sense, but keep your constituency close in that sense. Don't get too far out ahead where they don't understand what you're trying to do. And I think on one hand, Clinton sort of failed with the First Lady on their plan because, in a sense, maybe they were too much in control. And it seemed that Obama succeeded because he could stay somewhat aloof about it and let it, even though he may have been operated and his operatives were working on it. So it's a different idea. And I think, and maybe you could comment on that, was Obama cognizant of Clinton's failure on his health care initiative?
Excuse me, yes. The Obama administration played enormous attention to what happened in 93 and 94 when President Clinton and the First Lady were pushing for health reform and failing and failed. They took several lessons. One, as you talk about, was the Clintons gave a very detailed proposal to Congress, and that really sort of superseded Congress's role. And instead, what the Obama administration is, they gave a general framework to Congress. It was a general framework which groups like ours had supported, and so you had the Democratic leadership in the Congress as well as the White House in the same general place, but they allowed the Congress's prerogative of writing detailed legislation. Another mistake the Clintons made is they came with something that was new. They called managed competition.
Right.
And Clinton thought, because it was new, it would be attractive. And that's actually absolutely wrong in healthcare. People are scared of change. Healthcare is such a personal thing that people really worry about change. They want the system to improve. They want access that's there. They want it to be affordable, but they don't want too much change.
Right. They don't want to They don't want to lose what they have before.
Right. And that's exactly what the president always said. Yeah. Under my plan, you can keep what you have if you like it. And actually, he improved what you have by, as I said, by regulating private insurance, even at work, so it's better. Right. But still allowed you to keep that private insurance.
Right.
And so that was a very important difference than the Clinton plan.
Right. We have to go to a break. My guest is author and Roosevelt fellow Richard Kirsch, our subject is Insider's View of Healthcare. He's author of Fighting for Health. You're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM, live streaming WVOX. We have to go to a commercial break. We'll be back in a short moment or so. Thank you.
World and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. As GOP candidates gear up for tonight's debate in Arizona, Newt Gingrich slamming the current administration.
You know this is an administration that is refusing to face reality.
Many polls show him trailing Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum.
Several new polls show those two in a dead heat in Michigan, but a separate NBC Marist survey here in Arizona has Romney 16 points ahead of Santorum. Those responding to that poll here saying electability in November is paramount.
Fox Radio's Rich Johnson, rescue workers on the scene of a deadly train crash in Argentina. The country's worst in decades, killing dozens of people, leaving around 600 hurt. A packed train slamming into the end of line in a busy Buenos Aires station.
Passengers say their windows exploded and people were thrown into each other as they stood waiting in the packed cars.
Fox Radio's David Noto, Fox News. We report, you decide.
All anticipating Mayor Norm Bramson's Nourishell State of the City address. This all-important event will take place on Thursday evening, March 1st. The WVOX news staff will attend and will tape the mayor's message. WVOX will rebroadcast the speech in its entirety to be aired the very next morning, March 2nd, at 9 a.m. This broadcast is being made possible through the generosity of Nourishel Chevrolet, 291 Main Street, right here in Nourishel. Once again, be sure to listen at 9 a.m. on Friday, March 2nd, to the rebroadcast of the State of the City Address when Mayor Norm Bramson reported on what has happened, what is happening, and what is planned for the future of our great city of New Rochelle. And we thank New Rochelle Chevrolet for bringing the State of the City Address to the WVOX listeners.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of Ursuline Academy, Irma Valencia, NFL star running back Ray Rice, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
He won't be around forever.
Old Man Winter!
In the meantime, thanks for keeping warm with WVOX Worldwide.
WVOX.
Back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates with my guest, Richard Kirsch, a fellow of the Roosevelt Institute. He's the author of Fighting for Our Health. I have it right here in front of me, The Epic Battle to Make Healthcare a Right in the United States. We've discussed healthcare, its history, effort to get Francis Perkins to get it involved in the Social Security Act, FDR's second Bill of Rights. With regards to the struggle over this epic battle and its critical need, and healthcare is critical need, you write of the rise of political instigators who fomented almost seditious popular zeal, like the notorious Father Charles Coughlin, a Michigan Roman Catholic priest of the New Deal era. Glenn Beck of Fox News seemed to play that same role. But there are others on the far right who, in the words of historian Sean Wilentz, had made assertions that the U.S. Constitution was not rooted in the Enlightenment, but in the Bible. Some of these people constantly talk of sedition, impeachment, and even armed resistance. And this talk is still around today. You can read their diatribes and paranoia in many of the far-right blogs. Richard, were they responsible for raising the decibel level of the political cynicism to almost unheard-of levels?
Absolutely. And it was interesting. You know, everybody saw the Tea Party rebellion at town hall meetings in August of 2009. And people were saying a lot of the same things around the country. They're talking about the Constitution and the Bible almost as if they were the same thing. Mm-hmm. And we kept hearing this over and over again. And historian Sean Wilentz did a great piece in The New Yorker revealing where this came from, which was a book, and I can't remember right now the author, but this right-wing John Birch author who had written this theory that the Constitution was really based in the Bible, which is totally ridiculous.
Of course.
And Glenn Beck had popularized this on his show, and the book had leaped to like a 250,000 copy bestseller. Mm. And these folks were listening to Glenn Beck and believing these lies and had a tremendous amount of anger. And so you had the same distorted message that really was foreign to the Constitution and foreign to our sense of democracy as a place where people have can listen to each other respectfully and understand that we all have a common sense of purpose here, not that we're enemies of each other and that somehow the country is being ruined by those people who actually want to see a sense of common concern for each other's welfare.
Yeah, stolen away. You know, it's interesting as you bring up that fact, almost 10 out of the 11 founding fathers other than John Jay were basically deists. And if you read the readings of Jefferson and Adams, not to be heretical here, they all believed in God, but few believed in Christianity even. They were proponents of the Enlightenment. They believed in the separation of church and state, and they escaped from the continental system of church-dominated state. And ironically, the tradition of this country wasn't the Puritans or the Pilgrims who were religious zealots. People ran away from that, too. I mean, maybe the great people we should think about were Roger Williams and Ann Hutchinson, as opposed to Judge Seabury and, you know, the Salem witch trials. You know, from a political perspective, President Obama suffered large congressional losses in 2010, which not only mirrored but exceeded President Clinton's losses in 1994, though he's held the Senate. But this seemed to echo the issue of Clinton's own health care reform battle. What went wrong in 2010, and why did Obama fail to sell his effort and get out the vote?
Well, the biggest loss in 2010 was among seniors, and this is an extraordinary irony. The legislation that passed included reductions in Medicare spending over time, half a trillion dollars over 10 years less than would have planned. But they weren't from cutting benefits. It's actually benefits were increased. People got, on Medicare, got free preventive care for the first time. Prescription drug costs were lowered. Mm. But seniors are so sensitive to Medicare that Republicans really demagogued on it and used that in the campaign to scare seniors, and they turned out in big numbers and voted overwhelmingly against Democrats in the swing races around the country. And that really made the difference. So you had an irony that this plan that actually expanded, improved Medicare, and provided expansion of government was opposed because people thought it cut Medicare. And it was just pure, very clever, powerful demagoguery by Karl Rove and Republicans. And the president, though, did not, he ran away from the issue, and so did Democrats. And that was a big mistake. Mm. They should have taken it on head-on directly. Mm. They tried to talk about other things, and that was a big mistake. You can't, if you're being attacked, you've got to defend yourself. There's a lot to defend. He could have talked very vigorously about the benefits, talked about the lies. You know, politicalfact.com in 2009, 2010 talked about the biggest lies being around the Affordable Care Act. Mm. And a government takeover of health care. And they should have fought back much more vigorously.
Right. You know, obviously, all incumbent presidents have lost support in their first off-year elections, except FDR in 1934. Understandably, with the great work he did, and George W. Bush, who received some minor gains in 2002, reflective of 9/11 and sort of like a reinvigorated patriotism. Are there some lessons to be learned from 2008 and 2010? And are the Democrats understandably serious about these 33 million less voters who came out in the off-year election?
Oh, yes, they're very concerned. And, you know, off-year elections tend to have much lower turnout. And so there'll be a huge effort by Democrats to turn people out, and including constituencies that were very important in 2008, including young people, including unmarried women, including Latinos, African Americans. These are all constituencies that tend to have lower voter turnout unless they're really organized to turn out. And there'll be a huge push by Democrats to get those constituencies out, just as Republicans will work hard to get evangelical Christians and other parts of their base out, too. Mm. So we'll see much bigger turnout in 2008. You know, the question for 2012, I mean, the question for 2012 will turn on the economy, and will turn on really a choice between the president and whoever the Republican is, and you know whether people's frustrations with the economy will be taken out on the president, or people will say we're frustrated, but given the choice, we think that it's better to stick with the president.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of challenges facing health care reform. The Supreme Court is reviewing this spring the individual mandate provision of the plan. The Republicans seem to be planning a run on a platform of repeal. How important is the individual mandate, and could running against health care reform backfire? And also answer to me, are the British and Canadian systems so terrible?
Okay, well, there's a lot there.
I know. So just we only have a minute or so.
Just your last question. No, the British and Canadian systems aren't so terrible.
Right.
They're actually, people in those countries like them a lot more than our system here. Right. In terms of quality of care measures, objective quality of care measures, people do better there and at a less cost.
Right.
In terms of the individual mandate, which is the requirement that most people, not all, that most people have to purchase coverage, that people who don't or if you can't afford it, it's very important the way the law is structured. And when people understand that if you don't have that, it's hard to have the pre-existing condition ban. In addition, you're not being asked to buy coverage like you have now. You can have subsidies based on your income. Then when people understand it, they actually begin to support it. But until it actually is in effect, they're not going to understand it. If the Supreme Court were to rule against it, and it probably won't, but it might, it would require changes in the law. And that, you know, throws the whole thing back to Congress, which is kind of scary given that you have Republicans controlling the House. And so that's the sort of scary thing. Obviously, a big question is, who's elected president and all this. If Mitt Romney is the Republican candidate, it's going to be very hard for the Affordable Care Act to be a big issue in the election because Romney Care is really the predecessor and very similar to Obamacare. And Governor Romney should be proud of it. It's an enormous accomplishment. In Massachusetts, 98% of people are covered. 99.5% of children are covered. Healthcare costs are coming down. More businesses are providing coverage. And if it wasn't for the fact that Romney's so desperate to appeal to the right, he could rightly claim it as an enormous accomplishment.
I like to hold some of my guests' feet to the fire in an election year. Who do you see as the GOP nominee, and what do you think of President Obama's chances with that nominee? That's you can back off it if you want. It's okay.
Well, you know, I'm going to say they're both close calls between Santorum and Romney. Romney does have the organization. He does have the money, but, you know, he doesn't have the majority of Republicans. He's likely to get it, but if Santorum won, it wouldn't be surprising. If the economy continues to
improve,
and first of all, if Santorum's the nominee, Obama wins, and I think that's one of the biggest arguments Romney's got for him. If Romney's the nominee, he's hurt himself enough. Obama's more likely to win than not, but people are still hurting economically, and that keeps Romney in the game.
I got to run. I want to thank you, Richard Kirsch, for an enlightening hour. Thank you very much. And looking forward to more activities on your part. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access on my website, advocates-wvox, where information, my guests, will be posted. Next week, I'll be hosting Craig T. Williams, the author, will be once again discussing the power of the Olympic Games to shrink the world, the life of our first African-American gold medalist in 1908, and how his struggle and triumph affected social change. Thank you, Richard.